Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Capital punishment is one of the most hotly debated topics in America, and often at the heart of those debates is the electric chair, which is seen by many as a form of cruel and unusual punishment. Our guest this week, Richard Moran, provides us with a history of the electric chair and a conversation with Talking History's Eileen Dugan. And after that, in response to several inquiries, Kelly Schrum will give us some tips on how to sort through the myriad of resources on the web, not only to find what we want, but also to sift the good from the bad. But first, Dan Roberts concludes his three-part A Moment in Time series on the Battle of Kings Mountain.
Fleeing aroused bands of patriot backwatermen from eastern Tennessee and western North Carolina in 1780, Major Ferguson took refuge on Kings Mountain.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
Patrick Ferguson commanded the left flank of General Cornwallis's army, which was attempting to eradicate resistance to the British Army in the Piedmont and mountains of North and South Carolina. Having strayed too far west of the main army, Ferguson foolishly issued a public threat against the backwatermen, fierce and devout Scotch-Irish settlers in the mountain valleys of eastern Tennessee and western North Carolina. The backwater immigrants raised 2,000 men and began pursuing Ferguson and his regiment of 1,100 loyalists. Ferguson chose to make his stand on the summit of King's Mountain, a rocky spur of the Blue Ridge not far from Charlotte. Its slopes were forested. It was sliced with ravines which led to a summit that in 1780 was nearly treeless. On October 7, 1780, the Patriot forces arrived, their approach masked by heavy rain the previous evening. Their leader, Virginian Colonel William Campbell, divided his forces and encircled the mountain. They commenced their attack from two directions about 3 p.m. In 75 minutes, it was over. The Loyalists, outnumbered, surrounded, and silhouetted against the sky, were easy targets for the backwater sharpshooters. The brief encounter at King's Mountain marked the beginning of the end for Britain's southern campaign. Writing later, theater commander Sir Henry Clinton said, "The instant I heard of Major Ferguson's defeat, I foresaw the consequences. It was the first link in a chain of evils that ended in the total loss of America." The producer of A Moment in Time is Steve Clark at the University of Richmond. This is Dan Roberts.
This week we celebrate St. Patrick's Day, so in place of our usual segment, History in the News, we're substituting a quiz to see how much Irish history, well, let's say popular historical tidbits, you know. Here are four quick questions which we'll answer for you later in the show. See how you do. 1. St. Patrick's Day falls on March 17th because that is the date on which St. Patrick, A, was born, B, drove the snakes out of Ireland, C, died, or D, became a saint. 2. Just what is a shillelagh? A, a stick, B, a shamrock, C, a pot of gold, D, a musical instrument. 3. According to tradition, if you kiss the Blarney Stone, you get A, germs, B, eternal life, C, good luck, or D, persuasive eloquence. And finally, who wrote the following quote? If one could only teach the English how to talk and the Irish how to listen, society would be quite civilized. A. John Adams, B. John Kennedy, C. Oscar Wilde, or D. Samuel Beckett. Hang on to your answers. We'll give you the answers later in the program. And in case you're wondering, yes, this is Talking History.
You can't take me to the chair. You can't do it.
Who invented the electric chair? How did it come to be adopted across the nation as the means by which to execute convicted criminals? And what can we learn from the history of the electric chair that helps us better debate the issue of capital punishment in the United States? Richard Moran provides some answers to these and other questions in his conversation with Eileen Dugan.
Capital punishment remains one of America's most passionately debated issues, involving our notions of justice, morality, and technology. Is it right to execute criminals? If so, what means should be employed? How do we avoid meting out cruel and unusual punishment? As our guest, Dr. Rich Moran, professor of sociology at Mount Holyoke College, has found, this debate is not a new one. His new book, Executioner's Current, Thomas Edison, George Westinghouse, and the Invention of the Electric Chair, explores the controversy and the conniving surrounding the 19th century introduction of the electric chair as a purportedly more scientific and more humane form of capital punishment. Welcome, Professor Moran. What brought you to research the history of the electric chair?
Well, initially I was interested in lethal injection as the kind of most humane method of execution. And I was interested in how capital punishment had been transformed over the years, how we had moved kind of from stoning and crucifixion and boiling people in oil to hanging to the electric chair, the gas chamber, and then finally lethal injection. And I really began with the observation that each new introduction of method occurred in a period of time when there was mounting opposition to capital punishment, and that those who wanted to hold on to capital punishment would continue to propose new methods and propose them as being more humane than the old-fashioned barbaric methods as a way of making executions palatable to the public.
Before we get to talking about the electric chair itself, you give an interesting discussion of Edison and Westinghouse and their rivalry. How would you describe these two men as inventors and as businessmen?
Well, Edison, of course, is the one that probably his really name is almost synonymous with American ingenuity and American genius. Indeed, the light bulb itself is kind of signifies a bright idea or a genius. And Edison really began the age of electricity when he electrified or illuminated New York City around Wall Street in the early 1880s. And what happened was that in a very short time, he created a brand new electrical power industry. And then Westinghouse, who was more of an engineer, less of an inventor, and more of a businessman, began to buy up patents for a different system of electrical power called alternating current. And he began to cut into Edison's share of the market. Edison wasn't very happy with this because he really thought that Edison was trying to take over, which he was, the industry that he single-handedly created. So there was a lot of ego involved. There was enormous amount of money and prestige involved as well. So the two men got themselves into a very bitter rivalry as to who would ultimately control the electrical power industry. Maybe you could think of it a little bit like Coke and Pepsi fighting for the soft drink industry, or maybe Apple and IBM fighting for control of the computer hardware industry. It was that kind of a battle at the very beginning of an industry.
And was this simply a matter of who was going to hold the power plants, or was it a difference in technology as well?
Well, it was a difference in technology. Edison had begun with direct current, which can be thought of as water flowing through a pipe in a single direction. And Westinghouse proposed alternating current, which can be thought of as water flowing in a pipe in one direction, then reversing itself and flowing in the other direction about 60 times per second. And since it was the movement of these electrons, the water, that created the power, not their direction, either one of the two systems could work. As it turned out, the alternating current system was more effective, more economically feasible, because you could transmit it over great distances. So you could produce it at a power plant and then send it 50, 100 miles to the point that you wanted to use it. Edison's direct current had to be used within a half a mile of the power plant. So this enormously restricted Edison's ability to deliver electrical power to the outskirts of the city and meant that he had to buy expensive real estate right within the city itself. So Edison had a lot of disadvantages. The one advantage that he thought he had was that of safety, that it appeared at least that direct current was much safer than alternating current. And so Edison tried to shift the debate from efficiency to safety. And that's kind of where the electric chair comes in.
Well, why didn't Edison simply switch over to AC?
Well, it's one of the great questions of all times. To some extent, he could, in the beginning, he had a tremendous commitment in terms of an infrastructure to the direct current. But he even bought up a couple of alternating current patents and was thinking of doing it. It seems to me that in the end, Edison didn't switch over to alternating current because it wasn't his, because he didn't invent it. And I say in the book that many of us reach our psychological limitations long before we reach our intellectual ones. So he just didn't want it because it wasn't his. It wasn't associated with his name. Ultimately, his company did eventually switch over 20 or 30 years later because they had to. And ironically enough, Westinghouse was one of the first to get the Edison Prize for outstanding contribution in the electrical power field.
How did Edison fight Westinghouse and an alternating current in the 1880s? I mean, how did he use, for example, the courts and the media?
Well, Edison was one of the first. He was a friend of P.T. Barnum, and he was one of the first to understand how the media worked. He learned that from selling newspapers during the Civil War, how powerful the press could be. So what Edison did is he would invite reporters to demonstrations. He would spin yarns about his childhood, and he would start to write letters to say that the alternating current was too dangerous for residential or commercial use. And he commanded enormous attention, much more. There's nobody close to him today. Not even Bill Gates could probably get that kind of attention at a press conference. And Edison was thought of as a kind of almost a god, and whatever he said about electricity, people believed, because this was not simply an age of inventions. It was an age of inventors. And each invention was tied to a personality, unlike it really is today. And so Edison tried to use his personality, tried to use the press to build a campaign against alternating current, arguing that it was not safe. Now, in this campaign, he enlisted an independent inventor named Harold Brown, who had made a minor invention for a switching device that only worked on direct current. And Brown and Edison, with Edison working behind the scenes, Brown went on a public campaign to educate the public on the dangers of alternating current. Even had a demonstration at Columbia University, then called the Columbia College of Mines, where he invited all the press and all the bigwigs in the electrical power industry to come see him execute animals, mostly dogs, using direct current and then using alternating current. And during these demonstrations, he was purporting to show that a dog could take 10 times as much direct current and not be hurt as he could take alternating current. And it was there that Brown first linked alternating current with the electric chair, saying that the alternating current was only good for the dog pound or the state prison, and that it had no other good uses.
Whose idea was it to replace hanging with the electric chair?
Well, like all great ideas, a lot of things have to happen. A confluence of things have to happen together. Now, what was happening in the state of New York is that the legislators were getting unhappy with hanging, that there had been a number of botched hangings, and the abolitionists had introduced bills to abolish the death penalty, some of them coming very close to succeeding. And so those who wanted to hold on to the death penalty in New York State decided that they needed a newer method, one that could appear to be more humane than hanging, and to keep support for the death penalty. And so the governor of New York appointed a commission to study the best methods of executing criminals. And it was during that commission and the commission's study that Edison was able, through a couple of letters, sending word, later on testifying at an evidentiary hearing, that alternating current could kill a man swiftly and surely and without pain.
As I recall, they referred to it as judicial lightning.
Yeah, that was one. There's a lot of interesting names for it. The critics call it judicial lightning. But it struck much more than once.
Okay. So, in essence, can we say that Edison was trying to push alternating current for executions in order to discredit Westinghouse?
Yeah, that's essentially what he was trying to do. He was trying to associate alternating current as the executioner's current, hence the title of my book, and that therefore scare the public into refusing to have it installed in their homes or businesses. Now, of course, people didn't understand really how electricity worked in those days. I would say they still don't understand how electricity worked, and there was a lot of fear of electricity, as there is today, a lot of fear of electricity. And so it wasn't difficult for Edison to rile people up with, rile the fears of people up, especially since there were people, linemen, being electrocuted on a weekly basis as they began to wire the cities.
As I recall, Edison had a line about the best way to execute criminals is how? To use them as linemen?
Oh, yeah. He said that when he kind of said sarcastically that the best way you can execute a criminal is put them to work for Westinghouse as a lineman. And, you know, suggesting they'd be dead within a week.
Oh, that's a nasty line.
Westinghouse, after the first electrocution, Westinghouse came back and said they could have done a better job with an axe.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, how successful, so to speak, was the first execution?
Well, if you call it success that the guy died, then of course it was success. But I suspect that most of us are talking about, was it a quick and painless? And it was neither quick nor painless. It took over 4 minutes, and it appears that the man, William Kembler, was in excruciating pain. What happened is that they, although they had prepared for it, that they had gone through tests and everything, in the end they really weren't prepared. They didn't know how long to keep the electricity on. Nobody had a stopwatch until Dr. Spitzer found one. And they kept the electricity on for about 15 or 17 seconds, and they thought he was dead then, and he started to convulse, so they panicked and they shut the electricity off. At that point, Kembler began to breathe again and convulse. There's a discussion whether he was dead then or not, but he was certainly breathing and convulsing. At that point, they panicked again and put the electricity back on, this time doubling the voltage to like over 4,000 volts. And they left it on for 4 minutes or until he caught fire. And so he ultimately was burned from the inside out, and the smell of burning flesh filled the air, and that's when they finally decided to shut the electricity off, that he was now dead.
Why was there so much uncertainty concerning, you know, how long to keep the power on during this? I mean, what did they and didn't they know about the science and medicine behind this?
Well, it seems like a simple matter, one would think, just as it would seem like it was a simple matter, you know, how to hang somebody. But if you look at hanging, there were all kinds of charts that were related to a man's body size, his weight, how long to let him drop, because you wanted to let him drop long enough that his neck would be broken. But if you let him drop too long, his head would be torn right from his shoulders. If you didn't let him drop enough, he would strangle, which would be anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes. So that was the problem with hanging. Oddly enough, you got the same problem with the electric chair, is that if you don't give a person enough electricity, then it won't kill him instantly. And if you give him too much electricity, then his skin will be burned and he'll catch on fire. So the idea of killing a person becomes a difficult task when you realize that you don't want to create any visible signs of pain and you don't want to mutilate the body. And that's the real problem they have even today. One of the last executions they had of a 300-pound man. They really couldn't figure out, like, how much electricity would be enough. The other thing is, if somebody is nervous, which most people are, and sweating profusely, then the charge tends to stay on top of the body, running through the salted sweat, and doesn't run through the heart and brain, and the person will live a lot longer. So there are all these kind of calculations that need to be done, which invariably mean that from time to time, there's going to be some kind of follow-up. That's just been the history of all executions, that there's always a follow-up sooner or later. For Kembla, the very first execution, they were really experimenting because they had killed dogs and horses, and they even killed an elephant just to prove that there was enough power to kill a person. But when it came to killing a person without mutilating his body, they really didn't know what to do. There was, and still today, very little, almost no research on the effect of electricity on the body in terms of a lethal dose of electricity. There isn't anybody that studies it. There's one or two people that can speak to it, and that's about it.
Hmm. Well, we only have a moment remaining, but how do you see the electric chair as changing the very nature of capital punishment?
Well, despite all the horrors that took place at first electrocution, the electric chair became thought of as new, scientific, and therefore humane, so that the methods, the electric chair made capital punishment more palatable for almost a century. And it wasn't until, like, lethal injection, you notice lethal injection came in after there was a 10-year moratorium on executions, and states were going to start killing people again, and they wanted to make sure that they had a better method, one that wouldn't make the public uneasy. The truth is, lethal injection was thought of way back with Socrates. It was thought of, it was used in the hypodermic needle, was used in the Civil War, and the lethal injection came in second behind electrocution in the 1888 report. At that time, they thought it was unreliable. It was a lethal injection of morphine. They thought it was unreliable because the individual could get nervous, shake, and the needle could come out of the vein into the muscle, at which time it would take 30 minutes to die. That happens today. One out of 8 or 9 of the lethal injections take over 30 minutes to die. And today, we link lethal injection, although I would argue it's a low-tech death, we tend to think of it as a high-tech death, part of a modern medicine death. And because we have now lethal injection, there's more support for capital punishment than if we still had the electric chair.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Moran.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, we have been talking with Dr. Rich Moran, author of Executioner's Current, Thomas Edison, George Westinghouse, and the Invention of the Electric Chair.
The Internet has become a vast resource for us in our study of history, but just how can we be sure we're getting to the best sources? Kelly Schramm, who appears regularly on Talking History to tell you about various new websites, offers us a little web surfing 101.
History Matters provides a starting point for exploring American history on the web with 1,000 first-person historical documents and an annotated searchable guide to 700 U.S. history websites. The Center for History and the Media is also developing a website called World History Matters, focused on locating and analyzing online primary sources in world history. Locating the wealth of primary sources available online meets many teaching and research needs, yet it also generates new questions. Where can students learn to use so many different kinds of sources to understand the past? The History Matters feature, Making Sense of Evidence, is a set of tools designed to help students and teachers make effective use of online primary sources, providing guides with interactive exercises for analyzing many kinds of evidence, such as film, music, letters and diaries, and photographs. The guide provides important questions to ask when working with different kinds of evidence. For example, how is a film shot and edited? How do you make a flat map out of a round world? Who is the intended audience of an ad? Why was a photograph taken? Online primary sources are opening access to exciting resources around the world, allowing students greater control over their learning and research. Teaching critical evaluation skills for online resources is an important first step. Guiding students to reliable websites such as Library of Congress American Memory or History Matters helps them engage more quickly with artifacts of the past. And teaching strategies for analyzing a range of primary sources helps students begin to understand the past in more sophisticated and nuanced ways. To locate these sites, visit the Center for History and New Media at chnm.gnu.edu.
You've been listening to Kelly Schramm, Assistant Director of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. And finally, we leave you with the fifth installment in our 8-part series of the White House tapes, secret recordings made in the Oval Office but now offered to the public by the New Press. This week we take you back to June 23, 1964, in a telephone conversation between President Lyndon Johnson and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. An important catalyst in the struggle of civil rights in America in the 1960s was the violence of Mississippi segregationists. In June 1963, Medgar Evers of that state's NAACP was assassinated at his home in Jackson. A year later, crowds burned the African-American Mount Zion Church, and three civil rights volunteers disappeared. The news broke the morning of June 23rd in the New York Times. Lyndon Johnson was hard at work trying to gain passage of a civil rights bill promised the black community by John Kennedy, and he wanted the civil rights leaders found. In the late afternoon of June 23rd, FBI Director Hoover called with the bad news.
Mr. President,
yeah.
I wanted to let you know we found the car.
Yeah.
Now, this is not known. Nobody knows this at all. But the car was burned, and we do not know yet whether any bodies are inside of the car because of the intense heat that still is in the area of the car. The license plates on the car are the same that was on the car that was in Philadelphia, Mississippi yesterday. And apparently, this is off to the side of the road. It wasn't going toward Meridian, but is going in the opposite direction. Now, whether there anybody's in the car, we won't know until we can get into the car ourselves. We've got agents, of course, on the ground, and as soon as we get definite word, I'll, of course, get word to you. But I did want you to know that apparently what's happened, these men have been killed. Although, as I say, we can't tell whether anybody's in there in view of the intense heat.
Well, now, what would make you think they've been killed?
Because of the fact that it is the same car that they were in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And the same license number is on the outside of the car. Now, as I say, the heat is so intense you can't tell on the inside that everything's been burned, whether there are any charred bodies or not. It is merely an assumption that probably they were burned in the car. On the other hand, they may have been taken out and killed on the outside.
Or maybe kidnapped and locked up.
How's that?
Or maybe kidnapped and locked up.
Well, I would doubt whether those people down there would even give them that much of a break. But, of course, we're going to go into that very thoroughly. Not only as to the fact as to whether they're still alive. If they're not in the car, then they may have been killed and their bodies buried in one of those swamps down there.
You've been listening to President Lyndon Johnson in an Oval Office telephone conversation with FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover on June 23, 1964, courtesy of the New Press. And that's it for another week of Talking History, but before we leave you, here are the answers to our St. Patrick's Day quiz. 1. St. Patrick's Day falls on March 17th because that is the date on which St. Patrick C. died. Number 2. A shillelagh is a stick. 3. According to tradition, if you kiss the Blarney Stone, you get D. persuasive eloquence. 4. Oscar Wilde wrote, if one could only teach the English how to talk and the Irish how to listen, society would be quite civilized. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Joey Skidmore producer, Fiona Beatty assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau, wishing you a happy St. Patrick's Day.